Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Teachers in West Virginia made history this year by organizing a 9-day statewide strike. Union leader Dale Lee says the strike was kind of like carrying on a family tradition, and he's proud of his heritage.
Dad was a teacher. He walked out in 1979. I walked the picket line as a third-year teacher in 1990. And my daughter walked the picket line in 2018.
Now other states across the country are following suit. Some people are wondering what this could reveal about the future of labor unions in our country.
This is really a strike that is of this moment in 2018 and potentially looks a lot like what future labor actions could look like in this country.
We'll hear from a Southern West Virginia teacher who says the support that's poured in from across the country has made her feel optimistic.
And so I think that, you know, it just says a lot about our tiny little state and our tiny little town that we do have a voice and we are being heard.
That's all ahead on this week's Inside Appalachia. Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. West Virginia teachers across the state united as they walked off the job demanding better pay and better insurance benefits. On this show, we'll take a look at just how many lines they crossed to come together. Competing labor unions joined forces, and in the crowd of protesting teachers, we found Democrats, Republicans, and West Virginia Democrats. We'll make that distinction later in the show, but first, let's recap how it all went down. Thousands of teachers flooded the state capitol in Charleston to protest. They carried colorful signs to their local schools and to the capitol, some with Dr. Seuss quotes like, "Unless someone like you cares a whole awful lot, nothing is going to get better. It's not. Fix PEIA." Many of them highlighted the unity of the 55 counties by displaying the slogan, "55 Strong," and the hashtag 55 Strong went viral on social media. West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Dave Mistich was there, and I caught up with him shortly after the strike ended to talk about what happened. So give us the rundown. When and how did this teacher's strike start?
Well, we've heard a lot that a Facebook group late last year got a bunch of teachers together that sort of organically started talking about this issue of healthcare as well as pay increases. You know, as the legislative session rolled along or opened up, I should say, the heads of two teachers' unions got together. That's the West Virginia Education Association and their president Dale Lee and Christine Campbell, who's the president of the American Federation of Teachers West Virginia. I should note that in years past, those two organizations didn't necessarily play nicely together. They oftentimes seemed to be, I wouldn't necessarily say working against one another, but weren't necessarily unified in any particular way. You know, as the session rolled along, we heard a lot from both the unions. And on February 11th, these two unions got together, and their members all got together in Braxton County in Flatwoods and agreed to authorize a statewide work action. You know, in the next couple of days later on that week, the strike itself kicked off, and inevitably it turned into 9 days of teachers walking off the job and school service personnel walking off the job, too.
And you mentioned insurance and pay increases. What was this all about? What were the teachers asking for?
Well, you know, initially, and I should point out that this has been an ongoing conversation at the State House for years, the Public Employees Insurance Agency, for years we've heard a conversation about rising cost to that program for those who were on that plan. You know, they had said, teachers had said that with the rising costs and no additional pay, that these premiums and deductibles and co-pays and all the other aspects of this insurance program were cutting into their pocketbooks. I should say that, you know, over the course of the legislative session, a few things happened. For one, the House of Delegates tried to push some different ways to fill some needs financially for that program. The most important thing that happened was that the PEIA Finance Board, over the course of a series of meetings, heard from those who were on the plan, and they agreed inevitably to freeze some proposed changes that would have increased costs. Now, you know, that sounds fine and good, a freeze for 16, 17 months, but for these people that were on that plan, they were scared that, you know, another year would roll around and they'd be back in the same situation. So they were calling for a permanent fix to that healthcare program, as well as, you know, a pay raise. I should note, you know, right before this strike kicked off, the legislature actually passed a pay raise, 4% over the course of 3 years. It was 2% this coming year with an additional 1% the two following years. But with PEIA sort of being in flux in their mind, as well as, you know, that 4% not seeming like enough to these teachers, they went ahead and went on strike. So interesting sort of dynamics at play that even though pay raises were offered and passed by the legislature, signed by Governor Justice, that still wasn't enough for them to prevent this strike.
Dave, there was a lot of hooting and hollering at the Capitol during this strike, and there were a lot of people that went up there. What did all this accomplish? What did they get?
Well, they in the end, they wound up with a 5% pay increase this coming year. They also, like I had mentioned before, the 16 to 17 month freeze on the PEIA rising costs was another part of it. Most importantly, I think some might argue, is that this task force has been created to study the PEIA program, rising healthcare costs around the country, and to try to quell those rising costs into the future.
Dave, on social media, for me, I saw a lot of talk about, you know, one remark I saw was 5% of zero still equals zero. West Virginia has been struggling financially for some time now. So where did they find the money? What cuts did the legislature agree to make to the budget to pay for this 5% pay increase?
Right. Well, in Governor Justice's State of the State address this year, he called for some huge increases to programs like tourism and the Department of Commerce's Development Office. That money was essentially struck from the budget, you know, after these raises had passed. Part of these negotiations to get that 5% pay increase, not only for teachers, but I should point out all state employees in West Virginia. Another victim, I should point out, was a proposal that would have made community and technical colleges for free through a grant program. The state had allocated about $7 million to pay for that free tuition, and that bill essentially was sort of left by the wayside, and that program will not go into play this year. In addition to that, $10 million was taken out of Medicaid. You know, lawmakers said there was a $100-some million surplus in that fund last year. I should point out that Republicans had pointed to Medicaid as being one of the places that might be cut for this, but lawmakers in the end have assured folks that Medicaid would not be a part of that equation. So, you know, while there is no single line item, you know, $10 million would be struck from medical services, but there's likely some places that they'll be backfilling that as the need comes up. But they've assured folks that that Medicaid services will not be cut.
What kind of ripples has the West Virginia teachers' strike made on the rest of the country, you think? Do you think it will have an effect on teachers in other states or on other labor unions? It seems like we've already seen some chatter in other states like Kentucky and Oklahoma.
Right. You know, I should point out that Kentucky, I believe, the teachers that have issues with their state government, a lot of that, you know, has to do with pensions. You know, and over in Kentucky, I've already noticed on social media a lot of folks over there that are holding signs that say, "Don't make us go all West Virginia on you," speaking to their lawmakers and referring to the strike that happened here in West Virginia. Oklahoma, of course, I should point out their teacher salaries are actually less than West Virginia's. So, you know, we're seeing a ripple effect of this across the country. And, you know, a lot of people are pointing to West Virginia as the catalyst for all this happening. I think a lot of people, whenever they look at this, they've pointed to West Virginia's rich history as far as the labor movement goes. And I think, you know, if we see this spread, we're bound to probably all agree that, at least in some capacity, this has been sort of a reincarnation of a history past that we've seen here in West Virginia before.
We should also mention that as state employees at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, we receive PEIA benefits and are subject to the pay raise for public employees. And just a quick clarification, we're using the term strike in this show because that's how most people refer to this protest. But while classes stopped, schools were actually closed by administrators, so it wasn't technically a strike. This wasn't the first time teachers in West Virginia walked off the job. It happened in 1990 as well, with teachers in southern West Virginia leading that charge. History repeated itself this year. Teachers in Wyoming County, where I grew up, once again were some of the first to organize walkouts. During the strike, one of those teachers, Nina Tunstall, shared what inspired her to protest.
I believe that it's being compared to a movement because when a group of people feel that they are not being treated fairly and equally, we are exercising our rights, our constitutional rights to peacefully protest and to, you know, they say it's illegal to strike, but it was illegal for Rosa Parks to sit in that seat. And I'm glad she did not get up. It was illegal for Martin Luther King to hold all these protests and walk-ins and sit-ins. And I'm glad he did, you know. And so that's why it's a movement, because history is repeating itself. As a teacher, I teach history. This is a present day history lesson. I'm not telling my kids to open up the page to page 15 and let's read about the people who are fed up, the people that are being treated unfairly. We are talking about today. We're talking about Miss Tunstall's fourth grade class, you know? And so we're making a statement. You know, I've heard, you know, a little bit of public backlash saying that we are not setting a good example by doing this. We don't care about the kids. And that's why we're here. You know, the kids are our future. I would be a hypocrite to stand up in front of my class and teach them to stand up for what is right and then myself going home knowing I have $20 left in my bank account. And why? I don't work any less than any other teacher in our bordering states, you know?
You were telling me you work three jobs?
Yes, I teach full time, of course. I tutor also. I work part time as a social worker. I go in and, you know, check out homes and make sure it's safe for children that have been taken away to return. And then... occasionally, I bartend as well. So I got in pretty late last night, and we had a choice to either picket at our schools or I join everyone in Charleston. I just decided to go on to Charleston and meet up with my people.
So why are you working three jobs?
Just to get ahead. You know, my mom, I help my parents out. My mom is on disability. My dad's retired. And, you know, I'm a single mom. And, you know, just to make ends meet. I have car payments to make and mortgages to pay. And, you know, on a teacher's salary, it's rough.
Now, you have 10 years of experience. You've been teaching in the West Virginia school system for 10 years in Wyoming County, mm-hmm. and you're a fourth grade teacher now. So what is your salary now with 10 years of seniority? Can you share that?
Yes. I believe on my W-2, I made around $38,000 last year. And that's, you know, pretty high compared to most of my other colleagues. Starting out, they come in at around 32.
Wyoming County is the county that was the first to decide to walk off and start this strike. Do you remember that meeting, and what can you share about it?
Yes. Initially, we weren't really sure, you know, what was going on. We had heard things about our insurance and that premiums were going to skyrocket. And, you know, we were very concerned. So going into that first meeting, I didn't really know what to expect. Getting there, it was packed. I mean, standing room only. So immediately I knew, okay, this is something serious. The next thing that was said was our AFT president and our WVEA president started out the meeting saying that they have put their differences aside because, you know, they're usually in competition, you know, for union members and have joined forces to tackle this huge issue. And so there again, I knew, okay, this is serious. And right off the bat, immediately, you could just feel the tension in the room. You know, people were in fear that, you know, their premiums were going to skyrocket, and we're already living paycheck to paycheck as it is. The rising cost of economy, and even as educators, I spend a lot of money out of pocket, just in my classroom alone. And so to hear that even more is going to be taken from me, you know, it angered us. It infuriated us, and it also gave us fear. You know, we can't afford this. And so immediately the tone of the meeting turned into, we have to do something. We have to do something about it. We don't know what it is, but we have to act, and we have to act now. We started asking questions. You know, they had already had some informational meetings in other counties, and so we wanted to know, you know, what are they saying? What, you know, what are the other counties planning on doing? And at that point, it was just, well, we're just going to kind of wait around and see what happens and see what everybody else is doing. And just for Wyoming County, you know, that wasn't an option. You know, I don't remember who it was, but someone stood up and said, you know, in 1990, we were the first to act and we need to do it today. And so from that point on, we just kind of took charge and said, you know, if we lead, they will follow, because everyone is feeling the same way we are.
So growing up in Wyoming County, living there your whole life, your family also lived there. Was it surprising to you to hear, you know, the people stand up and lead the charge in this strike this time?
It was surprising at first, but hearing the background and the history of how it all went down in 1990, it kind of felt like an obligation again. You know, we not only are we 48th in the state, but Wyoming County, we're 55th out of 55 counties. We are the lowest paid. So I said, you know, I raised my hand, and this was, you know, all in the commotion. Some were reluctant, of course, you know, because, you know, we live paycheck to paycheck. The thought of walking out and going on strike and not getting paid is terrifying, you know. The car companies don't care. They will come and get your car. They don't, you know, they don't care if you're fighting for a cause. So it was very, it was chaotic, but I just remember raising my hand and said, you know, those that are last shall be first. And that's just the tone that we set from early on.
Quoting biblical scripture?
Absolutely.
The hashtag 55 strong is getting attention across the world. What's your reaction to how popular 55 Strong has been, not only within the state of West Virginia, but across the country and even other parts of the world?
It just makes me proud. I mean, you know, to be from, most people don't even know that West Virginia is its own state. And now all of a sudden they see it lit up on their TV screens in red. You know, the kids aren't going to school. Teachers are walking out. And so I think that, you know, it just says a lot about our tiny little state and our tiny little town that we do have a voice and we are being heard.
That was Nina Tunstall, a teacher in Wyoming County. There were some teachers who disagreed with the strike. In fact, in West Virginia, there's an entire organization called West Virginia Professional Educators. The group lobbies for educators in the state, but advocates against its members going on strike or walking out on the job. It's not a union, but the organization has 1,200 members across the state. Alisa Mullins is a high school teacher in Logan County and is the Professional Educators President.
We are founded on the philosophy that students deserve an uninterrupted education. And when we walk out, the people that hurt the most are the students. And I think that that's sort of been the mindset of a lot of non-educational community members for the past couple of weeks.
Mullen says that even though she's not against the unions, she doesn't believe the strike was the best way to negotiate with lawmakers. Still, she admits that a lot of change was made as a result of the strike. Those changes didn't come just from teachers protesting. Students also got involved, rallying at the Capitol. A group from Capitol High School in Charleston even formed an online group, hashtag SecureOurFuture, to express solidarity with striking teachers throughout the state. They issued an open letter supporting teachers and the walkout. Cora Dunlap is a senior. She says watching the teachers strike was like watching history in action.
The history of West Virginia, and specifically the history of union activity in West Virginia, I think it's had a tremendous impact on the way that people see what's happening today.
Her classmate Chase Goldsmith pointed out that even though the teachers weren't in the classrooms, they were still getting up early to go picket.
I think it's just very heroic, if anything. Every day, teachers have been going down 6-7 o'clock in the morning, going to the Capitol, wanting their voices to be heard. And that is what this government, this is what our country, you know, was raised on, was like the right to protest, that your voices need to be heard. And they're not taking a day off, nor us kids. You know, we're showing that I mean, we can make a difference, and this is not a day off for us. I mean, these people are laying everything on the line, not just for pay, not just for, you know, better, you know, whatever. It's about setting the precedent that, you know, there has to be fairness. Our voices need to be heard.
But not everyone was fortunate enough to have childcare or even food during the strike. Low-income families often depend on school for free meals. Cora remembers one interaction with a counter-protester while she was on the picket line outside of the school.
Some guy came by on his car, spun around in the school parking lot, and went past again to yell at us that the strike wasn't the way and that it was going to hurt low-income families. And I remember, you know, sort of catching my breath because we had talked about that, you know, prior. We had had that conversation. We'd overheard that conversation among teachers, but we'd also talked among ourselves that, you know, that you're not going to be getting school lunch, you know, and there are people who are going to need childcare for their elementary age kids. And, you know, I knew that my teachers had been organizing to collect food. They'd been coordinating with churches and community centers so there would be childcare available. They were doing everything in their power, but it wasn't like he was making some sort of invalid argument. We knew that, you know, this strike had a disproportionate impact on those people.
Still, Cora's support for striking teachers didn't waver. As a young person, she says she feels empowered by the positive response she and her classmates received, although she doesn't think legislators take students seriously enough.
They're very clearly underestimating us, underestimating what we know, how much we care, and underestimating, you know, the likelihood that we will show up to vote. Because every one of us who wrote the letter is a senior. You know, we're all going to be eligible to vote in the midterms and this year.
Again, that was Cora Dunlap and Chase Goldsmith from Capitol High School in Charleston speaking with us back on Monday, March 5th, while the teacher strike was still underway. Cora mentioned that some of her teachers prepared sack lunches for kids so they would have some food during the strike. One school even delivered a book along with meals. But it wasn't just the teachers and schools who pitched in to help. Businesses, churches, and community groups in every corner of the state donated food, coffee, and donuts for the teachers and students on strike. People even donated their vehicles to shuttle teachers to the Capitol. The teachers' union in San Francisco paid for 700 pizzas to be delivered to the protesters, while teachers from Michigan made the trip to cheer on West Virginians. During the first few days of the strike, Governor Jim Justice told teachers that he was working with the state legislature to fix PEIA, and they were working on a plan to give teachers a 2% raise, and other school personnel and state workers a 1% raise. But teachers wanted more. On February 26th, Justice tweeted, "I think you need to be back in the classroom tomorrow." That same day, the governor traveled to Wheeling, Martinsburg, and Morgantown to talk with citizens in a series of town hall meetings. Afterwards, during a press conference, he said he'd return to the Capitol with a new perspective, and he announced that he had found a way to pay for a 5% pay raise for teachers.
And to be perfectly honest, in a lot of ways, I was looking at this maybe not correctly. You know, I've said many, many, many times we ought to look at education as an economic driver. But maybe I was looking at it as what is the prudent thing to do and not necessarily looking at education as an investment.
Justice credited sixth grade student Gideon Titus Glover, who spoke up at a town hall in Wheeling, for broadening his perspective on the strike. Glennis Board met up with the 12-year-old to talk about the experience.
Hi, I'm Gideon Titus Glover, and we're at the Valley Grove Community Center.
I want you to walk through and recount the experience of the governor coming up to Wheeling and just that whole sequence of events.
So he was coming up to Wheeling the day before. My mom told me we were going to go to that. And I was kind of like, well, that's cool, the governor's coming. We went there, we got there at 7. He was a whole hour late. And then he came and he just started, like, saying things that I didn't agree with. Like, that kind of ticked me off. I decided to get up and say something about it. Sure, it took a little courage to stand up to the mic, but once I got there, it was like, it all just kind of came out.
It took a little courage, though?
Uh-huh.
There's
a room full of adults, and I'm like, I don't know if they'd speak this better than me, but I just decided to go up there and do it.
And when did you decide? When did you decide you were going to say something? There at the event or beforehand?
Beforehand, I was like, could I say something to him? My mom was like, well, you better run it through me, whatever you're going to say, because sometimes I can be a little brash, but she thought it was okay, so she looked up the numbers on how much was allotted to tourism.
Yes, please.
You proposed to make the tourism budget $20 million per year. You said you would find that, so why can't you find enough? Like, you're finding $5 million for tourism when you own the Greenbrier. That's a conflict of interest.
At what point did you have the gumption to address the governor? I mean, he's a big man. He's kind of intimidating. Did you find him intimidating?
Not at all, because I don't care if someone's in a position of authority. The people are the people that got him there, so we have the right to speak our minds. Then I think it was like 5 minutes later, he called me back up. It was crazy.
An investment in West Virginia tourism brings in instantaneous money, instant money that I could help you with. If you throw it away, how smart are you being?
So then he said, if I put $20 million into tourism, and then I get $160 million back, you're making $140 million profit.
If you put money in schools, you're making smart people. And if you have smart people, you can make more smart investments.
Very good. Very good. Very good. Excellent. And hold on, you're a smart man. That's the best point you made. That is a home run point, son. And I'm proud of you for it. That's a real good one. What grade do you answer?
Six.
And even the governor cheered you on, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how did that make you feel?
That made me feel good, since I know that he was the one I was trying to persuade, and apparently I did.
There's been a lot of back and forth since then. Do you feel like you played a role in bringing this strike to a resolution?
Yes, I think I did.
And how did that make you feel?
That made me feel great, knowing that I actually did something, I made an impact.
What do you feel the role of young people is in the state when it comes to these big problems that feel like adult problems?
I think the role of children is everything, because children are the future.
And so how can children be involved?
How can children be involved? Speak your mind. I'd say that. Speak your mind and, if you have an idea, try it out.
And what advice directly do you have for other kids in the state?
Do your best.
Chants, tireless cheers, and singing rang through the halls of the state capitol for days. And one young man from Wyoming County, Nick Walker, brought his youth group from the Mullins Pentecostal Holiness Church to the Senate steps to say a prayer on Monday, March 5th.
I want you to bow your heads, lift your hands. I want you to pray in your own words that God will do what He wants to do in this state. The Lord is using these teachers to show the church how to unify.
Amen.
Because the reality is this. If the church, if the denominations would unify like the counties have unified,
the day after Nick Walker and his youth group's prayer, the strike finally ended. After weeks of debate, lawmakers passed a bill that met the demands of the teachers and school personnel. When we come back, we'll explore what this historic moment could mean for labor and politics in West Virginia and across the country. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
There were three unions that unified for this cause: the American Federation of Teachers, the West Virginia School Service Personnel, and the West Virginia Education Association. I sat down with Education Association President Dale Lee the day that school employees went back to work.
I can't tell you the emotion that was going through when the governor signed the bill and handed it to me, because I'm proud of my heritage. You know, my dad was a teacher. He walked out in 1979. I walked the picket line as a third-year teacher in 1990. And my daughter walked the picket line in 2018. So to know that here were three generations of us fighting the same battle over pay and benefits and getting respect back. I hope that someday in the future, if my daughter's children were to become teachers, that they don't have the same battle.
Are they happy with the 5%? And do you think that they might ask for more later moving forward?
I think Governor Justice said that after his discussion in the town hall meetings, he thought, I wasn't thinking about this right. Instead of funding education, we needed to make an investment in education. And he's exactly right. If you want economic development, economic growth in West Virginia, you have to have a high-quality education system, the best. And you can't do that when you have 700-plus positions without a certified teacher in them. So this is step one of the investment. Now, if you're investing for your long-term future, you don't make an initial deposit and then wait for years and years and years and never put any more money in, because you're not going to build a future. This way, you make the initial investment now, and you keep investing in our education system and in our children, and you will see economic growth.
Where do you think these cuts should come from?
I think it should have come from the governor's increase in revenue estimate. But with that being said, taking $10 million from Medicaid, and there are those who will say, oh, you're taking from the poor that need to Medicaid. We have $175 million surplus in Medicaid. This is not going to cause any West Virginian to have any break in service, any cut in service, anything else. And I'm very proud of that, because we wouldn't accept any deal. We wouldn't let anything go through that was going to hurt West Virginians. This is going to benefit all West Virginians, because it's going to benefit our children.
While the rest of the country is watching, Lee says there is a takeaway for people in other states.
But what I believe this strike has done, has shown the importance of standing together and uniting, because that's what we did. We united. Now, it also will show that if you stand your ground, right will prevail, and that's what we saw. What I hope this also does is show those other states that you stand united, stand firm, but I hope it shows governors and legislators of these other states that people will unite and will stand up, and it's time to give them pay them their due diligence before it gets to the point where you have to have a strike.
As Dale Lee mentioned, this wasn't the first time teachers walked off the job. It happened in 1990 as well. And while they were fighting for some of the same things, better pay and better insurance benefits, there are several differences between the two strikes. For starters, only 47 of West Virginia's 55 counties participated in the strike of 1990. At the time, some teachers were threatened with injunctions and risked being arrested for participating in the strike. This time, superintendents across the state often traveled to the state capitol with striking teachers. Many of the things teachers were asking for during the 1990 strike are similar to today. Here's a short clip from the 1990 strike, courtesy of WCHS-TV and the state archives. You'll hear several teachers from Raleigh County who joined a rally at the state capitol nearly three decades ago.
There is not enough money to keep teachers in this state. There is not enough money to give our children the kind of education they need, and that can be addressed right here at the big house.
I've been in education for 18 years, and I feel like we are discussing the same subjects we were discussing 18 years ago.
We're telling the legislature the strike is for real. We're telling them that we're tired. You know, for 8 years of promising salary raises after salary raises and receiving no benefits.
Then, just like this time, the number one issue for teachers was the rising cost of public employees' health insurance, known in West Virginia as PEIA.
You know, now that we're going through this again, it's sort of interesting how many things that we see that were similar.
This is William Hal Gorby, a historian at West Virginia University who specializes in Appalachian and labor history. He says back in 1990, tensions between teachers and the governor had been building for some time, beginning in February of that year.
Early on, the governor proposed, Governor Gaston Caperton proposed a solution that he would provide 5% teacher raise across the board, very similar to today, by closing a loophole that had been given to the coal companies in the mid-80s to try to keep jobs and attract new jobs, and that had been largely unsuccessful. But then at the last minute, he basically pulled the deal, according to the heads of the labor unions, because he did not want them to go out on strike. Basically said, I will push the legislature to make these raise proposals a priority. In exchange, you agree not to go on strike. And I think that's significant to not view the 1990 strike as just the 11 days that the strike took place. There was almost a month of sort of festering tensions. There was much more also in 1990, I think, important for the strike. A lot more negative press coverage, a lot more sort of criticizing what the union's goals were in the strike, even from favorable outlets such as the Charleston Gazette, which, you know, is very strongly sort of supportive of the labor movement at this time, but in many of their editorials and even the tone of the articles sort of suggesting that the union has no clear demands, that this seems like a sort of roughshod approach to this strike and walkout. So that was sort of an interesting development compared to what we see today. The other interesting thing is how quickly in 1990 the state court system responded to the walkout. Very quickly, several of the counties, particularly Jefferson County and Kanawha County circuit courts, responded by threatening court injunctions to force the teachers back. Kanawha County had actually got one on March the 16th, but the strike ended around that time, so it didn't need to go into effect. The state attorney general came out publicly and issued an opinion saying that the strike was illegal, the teachers had no right to be out on strike. And even unlike today, where we haven't really seen any county board of education really go out overtly and threaten the teachers, a number of the county boards made very strong demands, and I think threats to the teachers is not too harsh of a word. The best example of this is a few days into the strike, the Greenbrier County Board of Education outright threatened that if the teachers did not return to work within the next day or so, they would all be fired. And when asked how you were going to get supposedly 200 to 300 new teachers, the board president just said, we'll figure it out. But they don't have a right to be out on strike. And then sort of those types of threats that you sort of heard in the media that were reported in the newspapers that were sort of also discussed amongst teachers themselves. Not to say that you haven't heard any of those rumors now, but they're not getting the sort of coverage that they got back in 1990.
Pay raises and better health insurance weren't the only things teachers were advocating for in 1990. Gorby says teaching unions also asked for the right to collectively bargain.
That was one of the compromises that the West Virginia Education Association and the AFSCME, the sort of public employees union at the time, offered to state legislature earlier on in 1990 to say, well, you know, the pay raise issue, as long as you are willing to take it up at some point, we're fine with that. In exchange, why don't you grant public employees in the state the right to collectively bargain? And it was shot down pretty quickly by, I think it's hard to imagine at this time that there's very little Republican opposition in the legislature. The state Senate in 1990 is 30-4 Democrat in membership. And the proposal for public employee collective bargaining is immediately shot down by the leadership, by most of the members of both houses of the legislature. The odd thing being is that if they actually had collective bargaining agreements, it would probably prevent some of the sort of, in 1990, the sort of disorganization that happened at various points. And even today, you know, to those that say, well, why did this happen? Well, what happened is there's no clear bargaining entity to talk to.
About a month after the 1990 strike ended, the state Supreme Court ruled that teachers are essentially public employees, and therefore it is illegal for them to strike. The ruling noted a clear distinction between public and private employees, saying that public employees in West Virginia have a higher degree of obligation to their employers. Also, as Gorby just mentioned, West Virginia law doesn't allow teachers to collectively bargain. Teaching and education unions can negotiate with lawmakers and the governor, but they don't technically have the bargaining power to strike an official deal with lawmakers. We saw this point play out in the recent teacher strike. Governor Justice announced a deal had been made with unions on February 27th. After his announcement, unions said that teachers would go back to work. But teachers went against union leadership and decided to hold out until the legislature voted for the 5% pay increases. They continued to strike until the next week, after both the House and the Senate voted in favor of the deal. So union leaders were not calling all the shots. That's why this is being called a wildcat strike, because the action was taken without the union leaders' approval. Now the teachers have gone back to work in West Virginia. Will this strike be a bellwether? Union labor in the United States is at a crossroads. There's a case before the U.S. Supreme Court that deals with public employee unions' ability to take dues out of workers' paychecks, regardless if they belong to the union or not. Union supporters argue that because all the workers benefit from union negotiations, all workers should pay dues. Those opposed to the automatic withdrawal of the dues say their First Amendment rights are being violated because they're effectively being forced to support union positions they may not agree with. Union supporters say if public unions can no longer withdraw those dues, it will affect their ability to raise money and operate effectively. The Supreme Court is expected to rule on the case in July. The decision would not affect private sector unions. Dana Goldstein is a reporter for the New York Times. She's been writing about the West Virginia's teacher strike and the significance teacher strikes here and across the country have on the history and future of labor in our country. She published an article recently called Fighting Poverty, Drugs, and Even Violence, All on a Teacher's Salary. She joined my colleagues over at 100 Days in Appalachia for a conversation about the teacher strike.
I think one of the most important things about understanding this strike right now is that the Supreme Court will be coming down with a decision this year in a case that conservatives hope will really gut unions. Conservatives hope that the Supreme Court is about to take away their right to have agency fees or to compel workers to pay union dues. However, West Virginia is a right-to-work state. The teachers do not have a state right to collectively bargain in West Virginia. So in many ways, it's sort of the last state where you would expect to see teachers in particular be able to sort of rise up in this fashion at this moment. And I think what many in the labor movement have been telling me, as I call them to get their thoughts, is that they wonder if this is an example of how teachers' unions can remain relevant, even if we're about to become a quote-unquote right-to-work nation in which no union can compel workers to pay union dues. That would be a pretty radical shift in places like New York, Illinois, California. But if teachers in West Virginia can really, from the grassroots, have this wildcat strike, which began with a Facebook group, not with union leaders, taking a vote or deciding to strike, this is something that rank-and-file teachers pushed, and social media really helped this come together. This is really a strike that is of this moment in 2018 and potentially looks a lot like what future labor actions could look like in this country. And when teachers' unions first launched at the turn of the 20th century, they didn't have collective bargaining. So there is a long history of workers that are able to organize and able to get real concessions from management without, the types of tools that we have traditionally thought of over the last several decades as crucial.
Again, that was reporter Dana Goldstein from the New York Times. In an article about the West Virginia teacher strike, she wrote, "The politics of teacher strikes shift over time, but in every generation, their leaders have forged ties to broader social movements." The teacher strike made headlines across the country in publications that also once dubbed West Virginia Trump Country. So just how could a state that voted so heavily for Trump organize such a widespread labor strike, a practice normally associated with Democrats? Politics here are anything but red versus blue. In fact, there may be more purple in the Mountain State than anything else. To find out more about where the teachers stand on politics, West Virginia Public Broadcasting surveyed more than 900 teachers and school employees. Roxy Todd has this story about what the teacher strike may reveal about West Virginia's political landscape.
Among the teachers and school personnel who crowded the state capitol and picketed throughout the state, there wasn't a singular unified political position. That's because the strike wasn't organized by Democrats or Republicans or even union bosses. But some in the crowds did say the experience had changed how they plan to vote in the fall.
I just switched from independent to Democrat.
Angela Nottingham is a 7th grade social studies teacher from Cabell County. She says she made the switch after watching Republicans fight against the teacher pay increases day after day. She thinks other teachers will be changing the way they vote later this year during the midterm elections.
I know that there are a lot of teachers out there that are Republican and kind of, you know, kind of vote with their party. I think a lot of them are going to look back on who supported them. And I really do think that they and the people around them, the people that they influence, will vote for the people that helped us out.
In 2016, President Trump received nearly 70% of votes cast in West Virginia, the highest majority in the country. We have a Republican governor, and Republicans control both houses of the state legislature. And yet, more voters are registered as Democrats. Could the party gain back some ground? It's a question being asked about many red states with midterm elections around the corner. We wanted to get a sense of where we're headed. So West Virginia Public Broadcasting polled more than 900 teachers and school personnel in an anonymous online survey. Disclaimer here, this was not a scientific poll designed by statisticians, but it did give us some interesting insights. About half of the teachers we surveyed identified as Democrats, while nearly 30% say they're Republicans. A majority said they voted for Bernie Sanders as their first choice for president in 2016. Most said they plan to vote for U.S. Senator Joe Manchin and Richard Ojeda for the 3rd congressional seat in southern West Virginia. Both candidates are Democrat. That is, West Virginia's version of a Democrat. For 80 years, Democrats in West Virginia held the majority of the state house. Most of our governors have been Democrats. But as political science professor Rob Rupp explains, the Democrats in West Virginia have traditionally been a populist party, pro-labor and socially conservative.
You have to understand that there are really three political parties in America, I say. Republican, Democrat, and West Virginia Democrat. And by that I mean you have kind of a hybrid party, a big tent, where conservatives, moderates, and liberals all joined because that was the only option for a rising politician was to be a Democrat in West Virginia.
Rupp is a professor at Wesleyan College in Buchanan, West Virginia. He spent most of his career studying what he calls West Virginia's slow-motion realignment toward the red in the state. He says the shift toward the Republican Party has been happening for a long time, but it rose to the surface about 15 years ago. President Bill Clinton was fairly popular here, but after his administration, Democrats on the national stage failed to resonate with voters in this pro-coal state.
And now they're realizing that to many West Virginia voters, the agenda of the National Democratic Party is out of touch with the state voters.
This shift didn't happen overnight. Rupp and other political scientists say one reason for the political change is the declining power of the unions. Labor has had a strong influence on politics here since the 1930s, and labor unions have typically sided with Democrats. But here's the thing. In West Virginia, Democrats are far more conservative than the national party. By some measures, they're not even technically Democrats. They're pro-coal, and they usually side with conservatives on social issues, like gay rights, abortion, and immigration.
The old Democratic Party was this big tent in which you had very conservative businessmen aligned with very liberal unionists. And people have difficulty understanding it, but the bottom line is, one, it worked. It dominated for 80 years. And two is it kind of kept politics rather centered rather than extreme, either extreme left or right.
Rupp says that now we're seeing the breakup of that hybrid big tent Democratic Party, a change that could have national implications. West Virginia may be a bellwether for rural America.
And now with the loss of power, we're seeing a struggle between should the Democratic Party turn left or should it turn right now that it suddenly finds itself in minority.
But with the recent teacher strike, some people are wondering if Labor and the Democrats could stand a chance of regaining seats in the state legislature. And what kind of Democrats could get elected? Ones that lean progressive? Or will they need to look more like the West Virginia Democrats of the past? One example of the traditional style West Virginia Democrat is State Senator Richard Ojeda. He's running for Congress in Southern West Virginia, and he says he voted for Trump, but he's been disappointed by the president's performance. He strongly supports labor and unions and was one of the loudest supporters of the teachers during the recent strike.
Our people are struggling right now. I mean, I'm going to tell you right now, everybody knows that these hallways are packed, and they're packed with people that are struggling. These people don't want to not be in the classroom. You know, we need to do what's right by these people. I don't care what anyone says concerning, it's illegal, it's illegal. What's illegal is how we treat our working class. That's what's wrong with this state.
If Democrats like Ojeda want to take back power in West Virginia and across Appalachia, they'll have to figure out one big question. How to bring back jobs to coal country? Former coal miner Nick Mullins is from Southwest Virginia. He says he didn't vote in the 2016 election, and he's registered as an independent. He says over the past decade, liberals have not done enough to appeal to working class voters in Appalachia.
To be frank and honest, they need to come off of their moral high horses and come back down to the level of the working class. You know, we need help. The working class needs help. We're facing longer hours. We're facing stagnant wages. People aren't enjoying life right now because they're having to work so hard and long to just have a little bit of happiness in their lives.
That's also the message from teachers and school personnel. They're facing longer hours, low pay, and high health care costs. If Democrats can convince them that they are working to improve their economic situation, as well as bringing other jobs to Appalachia, they may be able to win back some of the votes they lost in the past 15 years. But Rob Rupp says, don't hold your breath.
Old forms aren't working anymore, and no one has thought of new forms and new ideas that will be coming, but I don't see them right now.
Time will soon tell whether voters in the Mountain State will side with the left or the right when they go to the polls for the midterm elections this November. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd in Charleston, West Virginia.
The recent teacher strike in West Virginia seems to have sparked a movement. Following the strike here, teachers across the country, from Kentucky to Arizona and Oklahoma, have announced plans to organize protests over concerns of low pay and poor health benefits. Teachers in Pittsburgh also threatened to strike if their demands were not met. Imagine that. Bold West Virginia leading the charge of an uprising of the working class, united. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Dave Mistich, Liz McCormick, Glynis Board, Jesse Wright, Molly Bourne, Kara Lofton, and the West Virginia Archives and History. Music in today's show was provided by Emily Jo Tansey, Dinosaur Burps, Michael Howard, and Ben Townsend. Roxy Todd is our producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. Ibby Caputo edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. Molly Bourne is our web editor. You can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org or address your letters to Inside Appalachia at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. If you'd like to listen to any part of this episode again, don't forget you can subscribe or download all of our stories on iTunes, Downcast, wvpublic.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.